I should get us started. And again, well, this lecture, you can see, you know, the last year student complained that that there were just calculation. So that I inserted yesterday's lecture. I didn't know if I fixed today's lecture. But nobody is taking last year's lecture and come here to tell me if I improved or not. So it'll depend on you. So this is our final lecture, and we'll finally talk about QED. And yes, swapping is always allowed. You can swap. If you're swapping for fun, you can go ahead and do it. But just let me know, okay? The interviewer, it needs to walk in a room with confidence who is in it. It's not a quantum process. Okay. So that's what we're going to do today is QED. And to start with, we'll talk a little bit about the quantization of Maxwell theory. In particular, I want to talk about the photon propagator. I figured that that maybe that will improve your confidence this walking into the interview room knowing this photon propagator is good. And also later when we do renormalization, I'll show you why photon propagator is important. So we'll start to talk about a photon propagator. So I want to start with like writing down what you have seen before is there's the Klein-Gordon theory and the free theory up to a total derivative can be written like this. And then the propagator, as we know and love, in momentum space look like this. So what do you think I want you to conclude here? Why would I like to write down the Klein-Gordon operator and the propagator together? So remember our trick from Schrödinger equation trick, a long trick that is taking I and the derivative and send it to momentum. Okay? So now if you look at the Klein-Gordon operator in the momentum space, what does it look like? So let's say momentum space Klein-Gordon operator is minus p squared plus m squared. And now if you look at the momentum space Klein-Gordon operator and its propagator, it seems to be indicating something, right? In other words, we want always say that the propagator the propagator is the Green's function of the Klein-Gordon operator. And in momentum space, we'll find them inverse of each other. Okay? Inverse. And similarly, we see that the Dirac operator, the propagator is also, the Dirac propagator is the Green's function of a Dirac operator. And hence, if you write it in the momentum space, you would, should also find that it's inverse of the Dirac operator. And we're going to use this as our method to find out the Maxwell propagator. Okay? So we claim that the Maxwell propagator should be inverse of the Maxwell operator. Not a bulletproof reasoning, but should work practically. We'll see. Okay. So let me write down the Maxwell This is the Maxwell Lagrangian that you know from classical theory. Okay. I'm just going to write it out, what is hidden in these Fs. So I write out what F means. Hopefully that's not a news. And they realize, although there should be four terms, but every pair is the same. So there's going to be a term, looks like this. And there is the other term. Okay, so far nothing fancy happened. Okay, fancy thing will happen. But what I want you to remind you is, how did we get out this Klein-Gordon Lagrangian? It's not the Euler Lagrangian you start with. You start with something like partial nu phi, partial nu phi, maybe with half. I think it's with half. Right? Recall that your Lagrangian used to look like this. And you did some trick. What is the trick that you did? You move the operator over, right? It's called the integrated by parts. Says, oh, total derivative, who cares? We're talking about Lagrangian density. Okay, so we're gonna use the same trick. So total derivative, it's like equal up to total derivative. Still something we know where we are going. Nothing fancy. Still. So I integrated by parts. This meet each other, become a partial square. And the other one just have partial mu, partial mu, partial nu. And of course, what in the middle is what we call the Maxwell operator. whatever is a sandwich in between the field is what is known as the operator. Just as before in the scalar case. No, in the Dirac case, it's nice. It's already in between.
Okay.
Yep.
It's always a boundary term.
That's right. We always throw away boundary term. We claim the part. The total derivative doesn't contribute to physics. Okay. So the next step is still very easy to use. Sometimes you need to justify why do we do that, but let's do that. I mean, there is going to be a, you can consider a certain propagating plane wave, then you can do this. And what I get is this thing up to some sign. Because I have two of them, I just turn the power derivative into p. And I probably miss a minus sign. But you can see the momentum space Maxwell operator looks like this. And then now, all we need to do is to invert this guy, right? Then we're done. Well, you can see this is less, it's less easy to invert compared to scalar. Scalar, you just draw a line above, right at one. You're like done. This one, you actually have to figure out how to invert it. But it seems that up to now, it's no different from the scalar theory. It's no different from the spinner theory. We find the Maxwell operator, we invert it, we get the propagator. We claim success. Except we have some problem. So here is a problem. So this operator has some zeros. See, unlike the other operator, they are invertible. This operator is actually not invertible. So I want you to enlighten you by providing an example. For example, if this operator acting on P nu, then the first term you get a P zero, P upper mu, and then you get a P upper mu, but the P nu is again P square. So this is zero. An operator that has zero, well, as we know, zero is not invertible, so we can't invert this operator. Well, that also explains why our propagator doesn't look like this. Yep. Yeah, I should. That's why I write that, but I can flip the sign. Yep. Oh, there are two partial derivatives. They should definitely both flip sign. Or both not flip sign. Now that's an important point. Is that they maintain the relative minus sign between them such that they will find a zero mode. Well, that's not a very good. Okay, maybe I should say that I start to talk about things that I haven't got time to text into the notes, so you might not find the argument. Okay, today, half of the things are in the lecture notes, half of them are not, yeah. That's exactly what we want, is that we have a gauge symmetry that we hasn't imposed yet. So you are supposed to be able to pick a gauge and then start doing whatever you need to do. And that's what we're gonna do, is because our whole course has been admiring the Lorentz symmetry. So we'll stick to that, and the other symmetry is also good. It's just we're gonna pick this one because it looks obviously Lorentz invariant. Has all nice index contracted. So we're gonna pick this. So this is the gauge condition. So how is this going to help us? The idea is, since this thing is zero, we're gonna impose it to be zero at some point. So the claim is we have a very good Lagrangian. If I just add some zero in it, it will be still a good Lagrangian. So the gauge condition faced Lagrangian can be chosen. Well, it's chosen this way, but it kind of makes sense if I write it down. So you have the, we know and love Maxwell Lagrangian, but now the proposal is to add some zero, and it's added in the same way that it almost can fake like these other terms. It's still some partial something, a something, partial something, a something. And then we say this Lagrangian is gauge fixed. Because it'll only go back to Maxwell if you pick the gauge that this thing vanish. And people, if you look at the literature, they always write the prefactor as 1 over 2 Cassie. Never write it the other way, which is more intuitive. But we'll stick with this and see what happens. What happens is that you have this term. Maybe I should write it out. So you have partial nu, a nu, partial nu, a nu. And then again, you do integrate it by parts. So this term will contribute to the p mu p nu term. Yes? Okay.
So,
yep. No, we haven't yet. We're going, well, it just says whatever this QC is, it's gonna be a good gauge. So we haven't, so this is what people call the gauge choice. So after you pick this gauge, there is still further freedom to put to pick this Cassie. So I'm just saying, if you look at this part, which is this, integrated by parts, just that part, because that part is new. Oh, I could, yeah, sure. Let me carry and do it a better job. So then I get a 1 over 2 Cassie. But some 1 over 2 is going to be taken out. So our operator, once you make the gauge fixing, the Maxwell operator become it's almost like the before, but remember our new gauge fixing term shows up in this term because it has partial mu, partial nu in the middle. It would become P mu, P nu, and then with a minus sign. Okay, this is way less appealing than the previous operator by looking at it because it has an extra term. But it's also very appealing. This operator turns out we can convert. We can invert. I don't think it's very interesting for you to observe me showing that when they multiply together, give you delta mu nu. But they do. Because it's invertible, this is what the result of inverting. This is known as the photon propagator, because it's the invert of the Maxwell operator, gauge fixed Maxwell operator. And now you can see that everybody loves this cosine equals one choice, known as the Feynman gauge. Because if you make that a choice, you get, sorry, the tensor structure has to be there. But you get to the photon operator use propagator you see in the books, and it's also the one we put it on the sheet of Feynman rules. There are other use of other gauges, but I'll leave that for your next course in QFT2, and they will actually even more quantize. So at this point, I haven't quantized anything. I'm just hand waving, says, look, propagator needs to be the invert of the Maxwell operator. Hence, the propagator looks like this. But I didn't give you a mode expansion. I didn't give you something that can act, some creation of operator, annihilation operator can act on a vacuum, give you the state. So that will let QFT2. The next course will do it. I just really needed the propagator for the last item of today's agenda. So I thought that this is an okay level of gauge fixing, gauge theory, how to find the propagator. I mean, the really important lesson is if your theory has a gauge symmetry, which is not a symmetry. It just says you have 2 degrees of freedom, but in order to look pretty, you introduce some 2 other fictional, whatever, not propagating, whatever you call it, degrees of freedom. You want to write your theory like this, wow, how pretty is this, right? Now, if you think, no, you only write down the 2 propagating degrees of freedom, then your theory looks less pretty. So that's what a gauge symmetry means, is you introduce extra auxiliary things to achieve whatever you want. And here is an example how to actually gauge fixing, and in the process finding the propagator. So this derivation is on Schwartz. Schwartz, and the title is a photon propagator, which I borrowed because photon propagator is very important. So before I move on to the next topic, is that, so yesterday I showed you a lot of random interesting theory, but they are all toy model. And I claim this is the physics. But in the end, if you do quantum field theory, your physics is often quite clear. Your propagator is the physics because okay. Now even if I want to say it correctly, I can't, so I just say it my way, you will get it. The chilling lemon formula, because you already derived in the full propagator that, did you not notice a difference? That's Greek. So I don't know who knows how to pronounce that formula. But for me, it's a lemon that is really chill and really relaxed. So it's a chilling lemon formula. Anyway, so the idea is that a formula tells us the propagator is very important. The pole tells us the mass, and the residue has to be fixed to be I, something like that, for this propagator. That's the physical mass in the full propagator, and that residue has to be I. So that's what we're going to use in the tutorial today, except for photons. Hence, it's important to introduce photon propagators. Okay, so now we are leaving hand waving behind. Maybe I'll do some more hand waving, but it will be different. So now we're finally talking about the QED renormalization. Which you will do the majority of the work in today's tutorial. But not the tedious work, the cool part. The cool part to find, hey, this is the physics. Beta function is the physics I want to find. Which calculation should I do to find that physics? This kind of cool work. The loop integral is dedicated into appendix. Okay, so that's what we're gonna do in the tutorial. But there's something I want to say before we actually get into a detailed calculation of renormalization. Is this thing called a super superficial divergence. So some diagram, it's really superficial. You look at a diagram, you're like, you are divergent. So it's a very nice name. So some physics terminology are weird, but the superficial divergence is a very good name. It says, I'm going to count power of P, because you know in the standard cutoff scheme of renormalization, P takes to lambda, so the more power of P, the more power of lambda, and then it's more divergent. Superficial, right? Just superficial. Okay, so how do we count the power of P? Okay, so here is the prescription. We're going to use numerator, subtract to the denominator. Sounds good? Then you covered all ground. So what's on the numerator? When you have a matrix element, what is, if you write down a matrix element that I invite you to think about the loops, when you have a loop diagram, what do you have that is on the numerator? Yeah?
P to the power 4,
the loop integral. Well, let's be ambitious and say it's a 4-times loop. We're not going to do any of the loop integral, so nothing to be afraid of. Just, you can have many loops. Okay, very good. Then we're done. And then what is on the denominator? In your matrix, when you write down a matrix element, now think about the 2-to-2 scattering that now you are supposed to be fluent or fluent in 2 days or 3 days when you next see me next. Okay, what's on your denominator when you write down any matrix element? 2-to-2 scattering. Propagator. Let's put it in two categories. For photon propagator, wait, we just talked about a photon propagator. Look at this, 1/p². Okay, each photon propagator will decrease by 2. So I'm using L for loop. And the P of gamma means photon propagator. Okay, what else could we have in QED? The fermion propagator. Okay, fermion propagator. Look, I sneakily only write a 1 times this time. Okay. So it's only 1, because if you look at your fermion operator, there's 1p up and 2p down. So in net, you have 1. Okay. You're like, okay, we're done, right? So, but at this point, can you tell me, just by looking at a diagram, it's divergent or not? Let me show you a diagram, okay? This is a 2 Robert. See? Yeah, counting all the fermion propagator and counting all the photon propagator, counting all the loop, it will take a while. So there gotta be some other systematic way for us to do this, right? Celebration moment. We have a T-Rex on the board. Okay, so there's some relationship. The relationship, if I have 1 vertex, how many photon, external photon, is going to come out? Let me write my vertex. Let me draw my vertex. So the number of vertex should be equals to the first contribution is from external photon. I'm going to separate all the photon fermions into 2 categories, external, internal, okay? The internal is propagator. So how many, for each vertex, how many external photon are there? 1, right? 1, right here. Okay, so N photon, and this is the external photon. But then, we're not done yet. For each vertex, how many propagators are there? So each propagator let me ask a different question. Each propagator will attach itself into 2 vertex. Yeah? So that's our first relationship. The second relationship is almost the same, but now each vertex has two fermion lines connected to them. So, but now each vertex will have two fermion lines connected to them. But then it's the same. There is external fermion and the propagator. Okay. So that's two relationships regarding vertex. The left hand says the vertex is attached to one photon line. The vertex is attached to two photon line, to two fermion line. And the right hand side is to count the external and the internal and all the photons. And there's one more relationship that I know you know because we talked about it before a little bit. Is this graph theory. We have a graph, then there must be this relationship. And this is the internal thing, regardless what you are. Okay. Okay. I wouldn't lie to you, it takes less than 3 lines for you to just stuck them all in here and say what they become. But I think it's incredibly boring for you to look at me doing it. Especially, well, it might be amusing because I might make a mistake. But I wouldn't do it. Refuse to make this mistake. I'll tell you what we end up having. So basically, we traded the loops, the photon fermion propagator, which is inside of the graph, to be the outside of the graph. Turns out, everything is determined if you're just looking at how many external electron lines and how many external photon lines are there. And what's even more amazing is look, we're looking for superficial divergence. If you're like, your diagram is finite, now we don't care about it. For now. Well, at least you know if it's a finite, just calculate the diagram. Okay, so see, I'm trying to tell you that, see, these minus signs is a plus for us. These minus signs are really good. It says, as long as you have any external lines, your super divergence, superficial divergence, this D thing, is going to drop. Okay? So let me list the stuff that, so what does D equals 4 mean? It just blob. D equals 4 is this blob. And do we care about this blob? Not really, right? We don't care about a vacuum diagram. They would be canceled. Okay, let's take another notch. Wait, why am I confidently, okay, sorry. Ask that question later. What about D equals 3? What kind of a diagram would the D equal 3 looks like? It has some interesting name called a tadpole. Okay, this we don't care either. I think Dan mentioned something about tadpole and why we don't care about them. Has something with LHC. Everything has to do with that. Okay, for D equals 2, so why don't I take 3/2 off? Why don't I set NE equals 1, N gamma equals 0, and I get a 4 minus 3 half. Can you draw a diagram with one single external fermion like? Not really, right? From the matrix element, you would know if you just have a U bar with no other things to contract to, then you're not going to have to be Lorentz invariant. Okay, two, I'll just add this. We'll come back to talk about this. Okay, this is our photon propagator. That's important. And it's important in your tutorial, but you will go through the winding argument to figure out why it is important. Okay, then we are down to D equals 1. Drawing more photon lines. Last one, there is a guy called a Furry. And he has a theorem, says if you have all the number of photon lines, this diagram will cancel. It itself doesn't vanish, but you know when you have a fermion loop, you always have one going this way and one going that way. Okay, let me put the photon lines on. So neither of them vanish, but if you do this computation, they cancel each other. So see, this T-Rex is not scary because it has three photon lines. It'll cancel the T-Rex that has the fermion line going in the other direction. So we don't care about this one either because it's canceled. But at the D equals 1, there's something else there. What else is there for D equals 1? Two fermions. Just listen to this. It's two fermions. So it's a propagator, so it must be important. So there's a photon propagator, there is a fermion propagator. And then we're down to zero. Zero means potentially logarithm divergence. And then we're done. Okay. So this diagram ends up to be finite. So it looks like a logarithm divergence, but when you calculate it, turn out to be finite, so it's not that worrisome. I think Peskin has a very interesting argument why it's finite. I'm not going to make that argument. It's very long. Okay, and there is the last one, the vertex. So turns out, there are only three types of diagram we need to watch out for, which contains two propagator and the vertex, which makes sense. They sound like important things. Okay, let's take the 5-minute break. Yep. Finite means it doesn't diverge. You can do the loop integral and it'll give you something number. Yep. Because each propagator will attach to two vertex. Let me draw the line here. So, for example,
always this comes from the external line.
Yeah. So.
And here,
because each vertex contributes to the line.
the number of lines in the, yeah, okay. And the Euler characteristics. Right?
Yeah.
And one because
let's consider connected diagrams.
Yes. Yeah. So like this total delta or whatever it takes out one.
So the idea is that if it's not a connected, you can express it as connected to some power.
Okay.
So we never consider disconnected.
Okay.
Okay.
So what I'm trying to say is that like it's usually two, right?
No, one.
All the characteristic formula is like vertex plus vertex minus edges plus the faces is equal to 2, right?
That's when you have a 3D.
No, in 2D.
No, it's 1.
Really?
But we can just draw a diagram. Okay, just that one. So there are 3 vertex and there is 2 internal lines and there is 1 loop. And I got 2.
Yes.
What? Maybe I just write it wrong. That's possible.
I think we wrote the same thing with Dan, but I'm always very confused like why we write 1 and not 2.
Okay, now I'm confused too. So so we're on the same page because when I
remember from that one, it was just for moments in conservation.
Yes, so I think Dan said like this is general moment of conservation takes out 1.
Yes.
I'm not quite sure to like proof, like I trust it. Like, no, I don't really see.
I
have
a question. I don't understand this. And why there is this 2 here?
So if you look at this diagram, there are 3 vertex, and for each photon,
2 vertex?
1, 2, 3.
Oh, 1 internal vertex.
No, wait, all the vertex are internal.
Okay.
All the vertex. And then, this is the external photon, which give you this.
Yes.
And for internal photon though, it get attached to the 2 vertex, so it contribute doubly. See, there is only 1 propagator, but there is actually 2 vertex.
I understand that each propagator is connected to 2 vertex.
Yeah.
But why 1 vertex has 2 photon propagators?
No, that's not, that's the, that,
this
how is,
this
is the total number of vertices.
Okay.
Right? So total number. And so we can.
Oh, I see. If we want to count the total number of vertices as a function of photons and fermions.
Mm-hmm.
So we see that each time we have a fermion photon propagator, we have 2 vertices, so there is this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, each external photon is just connected to 1 vertex.
Exactly.
And we will get to this equation after we solve.
Yeah.
Do all the algebra.
Yep, you stick those 3 in there.
Oh, because this is just formula.
Let's just say that for a graph, we have this. We automatically have this relationship, and we can use it whatever you want. And one way to use it is to plug all the relationship into this one, and then this one somehow magically become only depend on the external legs. I think there's got to be some group theory deep reasons.
And the reason we didn't count this is final?
It's cancelled.
It's cancelled.
So for every single diagram with all the number of photon lines coming out, it always, because you have a loop and you have a direction of loop, you can change that direction of loop, and if you do this 2 computation together, you will get a 0.
Okay. And the reason we didn't count the finite one is because this is...
Well, we are trying to calculate, that's just a choice. We're like, we're counting the things that are divergent. Since you are already finite, we're not counting. It's just, it depends on who you ask. Okay. If somebody cares about the finite diagram, then they should look at the finite diagram. But for our purpose, we decide to only looking at the divergent.
Okay. And this is called superficial divergence. Why do you call it
superficial? Because it's very interesting. For example, this one's supposed to be logarithmically divergent, but it's actually true, not true. If you compute, it's actually finite.
So why do you expect that?
Because d equals zero, which means your result should be p to the power zero.
Oh, okay.
Right? Power zero means logarithmically divergent.
Oh.
It's like p to the two means a quadratic divergent. Oh,
okay.
A p to the zero normally means it's a logarithm divergent.
Oh, okay. I didn't.
Yeah. Where are we? Here? This?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Good question. I have been very sloppy here. But to give you an example, it'll look like this.
Okay.
There's still supposed to be a fermion line going through. Like a fermion line going into a diagram, it never stop, it just keep going to get out. Very good question. For the rest, I can just draw a blob, that's why I shouldn't. Because at least the two types of propagator will contribute. Oh, yeah.
Okay, you derive the photon propagator there.
No, I hand wave the part.
Okay.
I wouldn't call it a derive.
Okay, I wouldn't.
I wouldn't.
So I wanted to know what happens in the LSB reduction formula that gives us this polarization. Like if you're doing like one of the external legs of the photon, you're getting the polarization.
That's right.
How does that actually show up?
It shows up in the mode expansion.
Okay, so you do a mode expansion in the AMA.
Yes.
And then that's where the polarization comes in.
That's right. Okay, let's come back to renormalization. And we'll make some. Okay, I just want to say that we are doing QED renormalization. So it's going to be a little tough, okay? Okay. So remember our first step. And you to think of the first step should be the one stay the same, right? So the first step, you see, introduce a regulator. And you can just take a cutoff, and then why do you bother others? I don't have a good answer for it. And I hope Francois does, because I'll all say, yes?
So can you summarize, divergent, right?
It's a superficially divergent. If it's divergent or not, you have to calculate, do the calculation. For example, apparently, according to Paskin, the fermion propagator looks like a p to the lambda to the 1, linearly divergent. But if you do the computation, you find it's logarithmically divergent. So they just sort of indicate it's divergent or not, but we shouldn't trust on them.
So if d is non-negative, right?
I think the idea is that if d is negative, we're confident that it's going to be finite. And if positive, we're suspicious. They might be divergent. And for the specific diagram, because the idea is where I can actually classify all the potentially divergent diagram in this way. And you can do it for any, like there's nothing special about a QED. You can do it for any theory. You're like, what kind of diagram potentially will be divergent? I mean, maybe they end up to be finite, or end up to be less divergent than they are. It's all possibilities. But at least you're like, oh, that's all the diagram I need to study. Okay, I'm going to introduce a regulator. And I'm going to introduce this new technique. It's a technique. It's called, you might have heard of, the dimension regularization. So basically, there are two ways of to compute the integrals. One way is cut it off from infinity to lambda, then you can compute it, it's finite. The other way is you can integrate it in a different dimension. Okay, I do find dragging you through the appendix 8.4 of Peskin. Oh, I think it's 7.5. If you want to see how to do dimension regularization in four dimension, Peskin 7.5 is a great way. There is a subsection titled dimension regularization. So I'll refer you to that. But I'll just like show you an example that I see, which is really cute because now it's in one dimension. And we make our life slightly easier by considering a toy model. The toy model says you have an infinite line and it has charge density lambda. And now you have a dot here, which is x away. And this is the coordinate system. There's x, there's y. And the question asks, what is the potential? Okay? The potential is given by the integral of take a teeny bit of charge and see what is the potential. And then you add it up. In our case, we integrate it over the whole line. So you take this teeny bit, what's the potential? Because it's a number, so we can just add them all up. And of course, this integral divergent, otherwise we wouldn't talk about it. So this divergence. Yeah. Uh-huh. Good point. That's just a mistake on my notes. Thank you. Because I wanted it to depend on x afterwards. Okay, very good. So you ask, what's the potential? You're like, potential is infinity. Pretty good answer. But see this so that is in itself not the end of the world. What's less, it's kind of a more important is you can see that it doesn't matter. Like y is like from minus infinity go to infinity. So it doesn't matter if my x is at x1 or x2, they should be all equal. Okay? Well, so this is my claim. If the potential is equal at the two different points, then the derivative must be zero. And you're like, that can't be good, right? The potential's derivative will be the field. The field tells me the force. And so this answer, this result now is definitely wrong. Before it's just suspiciously being wrong, but now it's definitely wrong. What's important, as we all learned from many different courses, is potential is not important. Important is the difference. And using this without any regularization, then you get them equal. So that's not good. So what happens into a cutoff technique is that you simply integrate a little less. So you can ask, say, Mathematica to do this. And the result is you ask the question. So now I look at the potential difference when I remove my regulator, which is lambda, which is L in this case. You get a finite result. And indeed, everything works out. So if you just take the cutoff, perform the integral, and take a different point, subtract them, take lambda goes to infinity, you will get this very nice result, very physical, says, yes, there is, of course, a potential difference between two points. Okay, now we're going to do in the overkill way. Because if you open any book, that's how they are going to do it in QFT. And this is called the dim res. Dim res, okay, the point of a dim res is says, you shouldn't cut off this line, because if you cut off this line, what if I wonder about the electric potential over there? Your line is no longer symmetric. I'm going to get a wrong answer. Why should I pick the dot in the middle if they are all the same equipotential surface? Yeah? So, has an argument. So dim res says, instead of blame that the integration range is too much, it's divergent. Dim res says, you just happen to integrate it in the wrong dimension. Okay? So we're going to integrate in the correct incorrect dimension. So this is what the dim res is about. Well, what do you mean by correct dimension? Of course, when you integrate it in some dimension, but your result is finite. That's the correct dimension. If you do the integral kind of infinite answer, yeah, your dimension is wrong. Okay, so that's what they will do. So instead, do a one-dimensional integral. We're going to do a d-dimensional integral because I don't know which dimension is right. I'm going to do a thorough search. Okay? So this gives you some volume. You know, it's like 2 pi, 4 pi, whatever volume of the sphere that I don't want to write it down in the dimension. So then we'll do this. We'll do this to search for the correct dimension. We'll perform this integral. But there is a problem. You have promoted your integration to be in D dimension, but in order to keep your answer still a potential, which means you still have a potential, dimensionally correct potential, we are forced to introduce a scale. So dimension analysis forces us to introduce the scale. So here you see the regulator, if you put the regulator on the dimension, you have to, in the process, you are forced to introduce another scale, which is good. Remember renormalization, you need a scale. We renormalize the stuff, depends on the scale. And dimension doesn't have a scale. So this show up, which we shouldn't be too scary. And this is in contrast in a cutoff case. In a cutoff case, your regulator is the scale. You use lambda to or big L to regulate your integral. It simultaneously is the scale. If you don't take L equals to infinity, you will see some expression that L is the scale. But in this case, we regulator and the scale are different things. Okay, so, and I don't want to do this integral. So, this is where people get crazy, says, well, we want to go back to one dimension. So we should take that dimension to be very close to one dimension, say epsilon close. Then we can just send the epsilon to zero, yep.
The first one, integral of dy, it should be equality, right? It should be just promoting the
change. Okay, here. Yeah. And then we'll later send the d to one. Okay, right, that's right. We're just gonna do in the D minus D, in the D dimension, see what happens. And turns out, it's very interesting. These integrals really don't like integers. Mostly if you step away from the integers, you'll get some nice result. For example, and I will not do this for you, but the Mathematica will, you just stick this integral into Mathematica, as long as it's a D, well, D minus one now is some epsilon thing, you will get a result. And the reason why these integrals, including the four-dimensional ones, hits integral, the integer dimension, is normally when you do that integral, which Peskin will tell you precisely how to do, and where gamma function always pop out into these integrals. The integrals we know and love basically integrating a propagator. If you integrate a propagator, and you can see that eventually that integral, and a step away from integer dimension, you will realize that that a gamma function shows up, and the gamma function really don't like integers. Okay. So, what do we do next is to test this is the integral result, which is what we call our potential, and then you are like, okay, let's do the difference. And amazingly, it gave you exactly the same result that the cutoff scheme gave you. And you will do a little bit about this epsilon goes to zero thing in the calculation of a beta function this afternoon. But what... So there, here is like the renormalization schemes. That if you expand it in epsilon, there is some numbers because you have gamma function. And the scheme is to throw away the divergent part. That's called the minimum subtraction. Claim that's the answer. Now there is also the minimum bar Scape says, throw the finite part too. And you just claim the potential is this. Now, if you use this potential, it'll give you all the correct result. And for example, in QFT, what you will see is all sorts of momentum integrals. And then the top might be L square, L mu, L nu, whatever. And the basic idea is the same. You go to the D dimension and realize you can actually do the integral because the gamma is no longer taken at a zero. Gamma zero is not good, gamma epsilon two over two is good. So this kind of expression will show up in your result. It's no different except it's more complicated, as Peskin would show you. Yep. Sorry.
In this case,
it
didn't go anywhere, right?
It's like throw away. Yeah, it's not, exactly, it didn't go anywhere.
You just cut it.
You just throw away, says, it's okay. That it's not going to have any impact on any physics things I'm going to calculate. So that's step one, introducing a regulator. And step two, blame the coupling constant. And this step is very fun. And then who to blame, right? Well, you will do that in the tutorial, so I'm not going to disclose more information. Okay? We're going to have to wait this afternoon. You'll find that a coupling constant. Oh, you are the wrong guy. I'm going to expand. I'll do something, expand the do this. GR is equals to G0 plus some alpha 2. You'll do something. And actually, your tutorial is looking for that alpha 2. And I will make some physics out of it. Okay, so step three. It's kind of important, right? Physics. What is physics? As I said at the very beginning, what is physics is the propagator. Because Chilling-Lehmann tells me that the pole needs to be at a zero for a massless photon. The residue needs to be fixed. Okay? So, what we do is here is a photon propagator. Okay, I'll stop writing them. And here is what the people call the 1PI. So what's 1PI? If your diagram looks like this, not 1PI. It's like a skewer, okay? 1PI is the individual meat on your skewer, or vegetable on your skewer. And all the diagrams can be expressed as a skewer. And then my other way to explain it, it works for this one. If you have a photon propagator, find your tag of war team. Okay, where two teams have a tag of war, and then you're gonna drag this diagram, and eventually if there is an internal line appear and then break, that's not an IPI, 1PI. So tag of war should, this thing in the middle should hold tight. If this thing in the middle has a propagator, okay, it's not drawn correctly, and it can be cut in half, not 1PI. 1pi? Not. You will have lots of time with 1pi in QFT2. I'm just to try to use some analogy to say what is it. But the idea is I can organize all my diagram as diagram plus 1pi and then plus a skewer with 2 1pi plus a skewer with many 1pi that way. So I'm going to stay with the proof that because of a photon so special, turns out the two-point function of a photon has its tensor structure always fixed. So there is some theorem called word identity. Says if you take a diagram that has an index mu, and now you contract it with a momentum, this thing should vanish. Yesterday I was trying to explain it, but it takes 2 pages. So I decided not to. So this identity, if you apply for both mu and nu index, you'll realize this diagram, although we have no idea, we didn't do the computation to figure out what's in front of it, the tensor structure is actually determined. So what we're doing, if I write it out, it will be this, the propagator plus a propagator contracted with this thing in the middle. Maybe has an I, maybe. I'll just write one term. It has a propagator, has this thing in the middle, another propagator. So the next one would be propagator, 1pi, propagator, 1pi, propagator. So there are 2 1pi. And then I just keep going. And this is a geometric series. Okay, I don't have time to show you the detail, but what it does, if you introduce this thing, if you introduce this random operator, you can write the entire series so you can manage to basically, let me try to explain. So basically, there is this tensor structure into this IPI, can be grouped together with the propagator, become one operator. And then you can rewrite that series in terms of geometric series. Now it's really geometric series. But the bottom line is that at the end of the day, you do the geometric series. When you do this geometry series, you should arrive at something like this. And now you impose. When p squared goes to 0, the pole is not shifted, and the residue stay. And this tells us this thing has to go to 0. When I take p squared goes to 0. So that is our renormalization prescription. is that when you do your diagram, whatever is in front of this, when you take p squared goes to 0, should give you 0. Because this goes 0, you can see the first term is our propagator, which definitely has the pole and the residue correct. And the other two terms just cancel. So in the afternoon, we're going to find the beta function of QED. Yep. Yeah, yeah. Sorry. I should have figured it out this morning, but I didn't. I'll ask Dan. I think Dan has the answer to that question. Which condition? This condition is called word identity. Says any photon, any diagram with photon external leg, when you write the matrix element, because remember if you follow the Feynman rules, then it's always attached by epsilon. So if you have any diagram like this, your answer finally will be containing this object. And of course has this. And this theorem says you can erase any of this polarization. Then now, and replaced by a momentum, then the theorem says this is 0. I do have paid 2 pages to explain why. why it's 0, but.
Well, yeah. Sorry, I'm really confused.
Like, what is P mu here again, please? P, what? Pi mu nu? Pi mu nu is the evaluation of this diagram, okay. And all the 1PI diagram. But you can say we do it to the first order, then it should be all the diagram that you can write down at the first order. And then you evaluate all your diagram, you add it up, they should cancel at the p squared goes to 0. Like when we go to the one photon is on shell, go to the on shell limit, then you should find your pole still the same. Remember, it says nothing when you're not going to the on-shell limit, because remember, when we talk about physics, it's supposed to be a measurement happened at some scale. So this comparison would tell you nothing about We'll see a specific example, like in the afternoon tutorial, you will be calculating all the first the one loop diagram and it's a counter term. And you will see that you want to compare, you want to add those two diagrams for them to be canceled in this limit. So So you know the matrix element is labeled IM. And I'm saying that if it has some photon lag, I'll just write 2. And then this is the rest part of the scattering amplitude. And then people will call the thing in the circle the M mu. It's the polarization test. Polarization. It's not a test, but it's a polarization. So it says for any diagram that has photon lags, the matrix element must be written as some polarization thing together with the something else.
So here this M is the matrix element.
Yeah.
From which we extracted the polarization.
Exactly. It's like you write on the matrix element and throw away a leg.
Okay.
And the rest of the thing is called P mu. Yes.
So okay, it's like the question. Like, so generally, why I try to avoid, why I allow minimization in charges, but I try to avoid renormalization in masses.
No. It's not. We didn't avoid a renormalization in masses. We are saying that the mass needs to be fixed at the physical mass. So that is the renormalization of the mass. We're saying that the full propagator physics mass, because this one is that one, if once you measure a particle mass, we should leave it where it is, because that's of the physical mass. Like that's how we classify the particles. We also don't renormalize the physical charge. Like all we do is saying that whatever you write as E0 in the Lagrangian is not the physical charge. Similarly, the M0 is also not M. So I think in every way they should be comparable rather than one or the other. I do hope the tutorial will clear some clouds. Yeah. So you have a matrix element and you extract one.
Yeah, the matrix element without the epsilon.
No, that's right.
Yeah, so isn't this condition because of the reason that the max will overturn
is not in the
like, if you
multiply
by a
momentum, you will get maybe. I don't know. I wouldn't make that a claim.
So what does this
Well, physically, it's kind of like it says that something is conserved. Like, right? It's P mu. P mu means you do a partial mu on something, it's conserved.